From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We are joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccant. Most importantly, you are you, you are here, and that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. We live in what could be described as interesting times, right? And if you're hearing this around the time we record it on July 24th, 2020, then you know the U.S. and many other nations are currently dealing with a reassessment of how the civilian community should be treated by authorities, how they should interact with those authorities. And there's no question that, at least in the U.S., communities are specifically questioning how much they do or do not trust the police. The ongoing protests unquestionably play a huge role in this, but these attitudes didn't just pop up suddenly out of the blue. They didn't come from nowhere, and they're not, you know, a recent thing by any means. Back in 2016, the Cato Institute, which is a libertarian think tank, found that 79% of Americans support outside investigations of police misconduct. 89% support the use of body cameras. And it's not unusual, right, to ask for that accountability. And it's not unusual for us as humans to distrust people in authority. After all, one of the defining characteristics of power is that it is inherently vulnerable to abuse. So our show today takes place in this vast, at times contradictory, paradoxical ecology of power, abuse, accountability, and possibly cover-ups. Today's story is a very strange one. You may have, like us, heard about it momentarily, a quick headline, a blip on a chyron at your local news station, and so on. But here's today's question. Did the Milwaukee police just protect a child abuse ring? I know, it sounds pretty crazy, and we'll get to the crazy part. But first, here are the facts.
So around 5 o'clock on Sunday, June 21st, 2020, two young girls in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, go missing. They're last seen in the 2900 block of North 21st Street. Their names are Tidriana and Gilbriana Perkins, 15 and 13, respectively. And according to Police Sergeant Efren Cornejo, which is an amazing name, they're reported missing about 4 hours later. But according to the official police department response and records, the girls were not considered critically missing. I think this is something that's important for everyone to get their heads around. I needed to. There are some pretty specific criteria that will trigger an Amber Alert, which is, you know, basically a system that will push a notification to every cell phone in the area, will be on billboards that are available, and all of that stuff. Matt, I believe you had that list.
The biggest thing is, an Amber Alert is issued if it is believed that the child is in some kind of immediate danger or possible serious harm or even death if this child is not located. If you go to the city of Milwaukee itself, they've got a standard operating procedure, part of a handbook essentially, or, you know, the protocols for what to do when there's a missing persons. And in there, it describes a lot about children and minors in particular who go missing and, you know, what constitutes a missing person. The main takeaway from here, though, by the way, as we're thinking about the story and telling you about it, in this document, it has a note that says there is no 24-hour waiting period for department members to file a missing report on any missing person. Missing reports shall be accepted without delay.
Yeah, I appreciate you busting that myth. It's something that has been very good to fictional crime shows, the idea that one must wait 24 hours, because it's a hell of a plot device, but it's just not true. If you think somebody is missing, then report them, because in fact, the opposite is true. The first 24 hours of someone being
reported missing are the most crucial hours of an investigation, at least an investigation that you want to result in someone being found safe and alive. The idea of critical missing here has, according to Milwaukee, six points. Matt, as you said, the most important one is the idea that this person might be in physical danger. They might be a risk to themselves, whether that means whether it's because they're suicidal or they have, you know, drug issues or a mental or physical issue. One interesting point here is that according to Milwaukee PD, the person missing is automatically considered critically missing if they're age 11 or younger. And the two children who disappeared, Tydriana Perkins and Gilbriana Perkins, were both over 11. Tydriana is 15 or was 15 at the time, and Gilbriana was 13. So as cold as it sounds, this is a procedural thing from the perspective of the police, right? It just doesn't tick the right boxes to become an Amber Alert. And we should keep in mind that while these investigations are occurring, people are protesting in Milwaukee against systemic racism, against what they see as the callous and illegal actions of authorities, including the Milwaukee PD. So it's not as if this is occurring on a routine day. There are already people out protesting. And this is where we get to the specific day. You know, if you read about this in the news, most of the coverage was focused on this day, Tuesday, June 23rd, because over the course of several hours, this missing persons investigation morphed into something unprecedented.
It really did. And it has a lot to do with what we were describing earlier, which is just, you know, the criteria to report a missing person to get police involvement.
Well, and just to be fair, Matt, I mean, that's sort of, it's needed, right? I mean, to, you don't want to report every single, you know, call that comes in and blast it out as an Amber Alert. That would sort of diminish the value of that safeguard, right? Like if
the cop who cried wolf.
Right.
Sure. I mean, absolutely. There are going to be, you know, statistically a number of missing persons reports that are generated of someone who is just, you know, their phone died and they had to do something else. There was an emergency that they couldn't notify anyone about. Right. Or, a minor willingly abscond somewhere, right? But this is what I wanted to get to really quickly before we jump into exactly what happened. On that same Milwaukee PD document, under critical missing, like the classification of critical missing that Ben noted, the person, if they're 11 years or younger, they're critical missing. Another thing in here is that it states, a person is considered critical missing if there is, quote, reasonable suspicion to believe the disappearance of the missing person is not voluntary and or the missing person is the victim of foul play. Now, putting that in there, saying that there is reasonable suspicion, means that the officer taking that report essentially is that person or their superior gets to make the call of whether or not this suspicion is reasonable. It's not like the mother reporting a missing person. It's not the wife or the husband or the child. It's the officer and maybe their superior.
It's a good seed to plant, Matt, because I think that I think I see where you're going with this. There is subjectivity to some degree on the part of the officer or the person in authority filing that report. So this is going to come into play in a massive way further into our story. You probably saw this report about a crowd gathering at a house, but one thing a lot of news outlets did not report is how this crowd, some of whom were concerned neighbors, some of whom were searching for these kids themselves, and some who were already out protesting, right? How did they find this house? It's an interesting story. The mother of one of the missing girls was able to ping the kid's cell phone, and the cell phone was located in a two-story townhouse in Milwaukee on the 2100 block of North 40th Street. This is, for anyone familiar with the area, just south of Washington Park. So this mother, along with several other people that she knew, physically went to this property, and this was in addition to calling police. According to their account, this is the first part where the accounts differ. According to her account, the police apparently ignored these requests, these missing persons reports, for about 10 hours. So to your point, Matt, maybe they considered them not, well, we know they did not consider them, quote unquote, critically endangered. They didn't think they qualified for an Amber Alert. So around 10 a.m. at this place, the police have, on their side of the story, they've been investigating for 2 days. That's what they say, ever since this was reported. But a group of civilians starts to gather at this house where that cell phone ping allegedly originated from.
And let's just add in, like, not that this is, you know, this is a whole separate discussion in and of itself, but the police are certainly going to be stretched a little thin with doing crowd control at just the other protests, you know, that are happening elsewhere in the city. At this point, there likely would have been some police presence just to make sure that things didn't get out of control. And, you know, there's certainly a case to be made that there was a lot of overstepping and a lot of, like, overreaction to that stuff, and that it necessarily didn't need to tie up the police force in that way. But that certainly could account for the 10-hour delay, in addition to it not meeting those Amber Alert criteria.
It is a good point. Another point to make here is that pinging a cell phone is not always going to be as accurate as you may hope it to be, because you are talking about triangulation and using various cell phone towers to try and figure out exactly where a cell phone is at any given time. If you ever look at your location services on your phone, sometimes it's going to show you somewhere in your backyard or maybe at your neighbor's house. Just putting this out there as it's not 100% accurate.
So that's what this would have been. It would have been like a Find My iPhone situation, or like, you know, something that the mother could trigger from her device, not actually involving the phone company.
I don't know exactly how they were, what method they used to ping the cell phone, but no matter how they did it, it was using probably LTE or some other kind of cell phone signal towers to triangulate the location. I'm not saying that it's absolutely inaccurate, right? But I'm just saying there is a degree of maybe that wasn't the exact house.
Sure.
Just putting it out there.
And these houses are also, if you look at pictures of the neighborhood, these houses are also pretty close together. So, and it's a densely populated area, so it's possible that that's not 100% accurate. Back to the events there. The group that is gathered, right, they believe that these two children are being held inside this house. And this house, we'll come to find, has a story all its own. Police are investigating inside the house. They're not letting the civilians in. And according to the police, and we'll get more into their story in a second, according to the police, some members of the crowd, the civilian crowd, became agitated, and some people in the crowd threw bricks at the officers. This resulted in more police being called to the scene. By the middle of the afternoon, that crowd that started with a intensely distressed mother looking for her child had grown to number in the hundreds, and there were 15 to 20 police officers forming a human line, a chain outside of the house to hold back the crowd. They wanted in because they believed that the Milwaukee PD had a long-standing policy of ignoring these reports of missing children, especially if the missing children were not white.
And so at this point, you know, this civilian group that's assembling is starting to grow. They're starting to take matters into their own hand and search the area because they feel like they're not being heard. They're angry that the police took so long to respond in the first place. And so the crowd starts to kind of move towards the house. Some individuals actually break into the house. Some folks are smashing out windows. There's a vehicle parked on the property. Others start knocking on doors nearby, demanding to see these girls or asking if they're there. And then just before 6 o'clock, 5:45 to be precise, members of the crowd, which at this point is, you know, quite large and very angry. I mean, you have to remember there's a lot to be angry about. There's protests going on about the death of George Floyd, and the whole notion of not trusting the police is very top of mind right now. So they actually set fire to a vehicle, a couch, and then the house in question.
Then not only do you have a police presence there, you've now introduced the fire department, local fire departments, which, you know, it really does bring another element of sirens, of large vehicles trying to get through crowds, of, you know, firefighters trying to find a sufficient source of water to actually start putting the fire out. And just chaos is what you, that's how you can describe it, essentially. The police force there is attempting to control the crowd, essentially, to some extent, right? We talked about how they already had a fence, a human fence, essentially, around this house, and they're trying to do crowd control. And then a massive fire just metaphorically sets the entire situation on fire, right? In this weird way. There's also reportedly, by the way, Molotov cocktails that were used in this. At least that's according to the local reporting. I actually didn't see that in any video, but maybe you guys did. I didn't see it.
So we see that the discrepancies between the authorities' narrative and the narrative of the people in the civilian crowd who are live streaming on Facebook and active on social media, these discrepancies only increase. By the end of this, three people had been shot, two 14-year-olds, one 24-year-old, other people, civilians and authorities, firefighters and police alike, had been injured. The shootings are also their own kind of bag of terrible badgers. Police responded eventually by deploying what is misleadingly termed non-lethal, right? Non-lethal measures. So that would be your Whitman sampler of protest response. Things like tear gas, rubber bullets, pepper spray. That was deployed on protesters. Several were injured. After 7 p.m., led by a guy we'll meet later called Frank Nitti, a small group in the crowd began a protest march away from the site. They were followed by a caravan of vehicles. I think it's important for us to say windows were smashed out of this vehicle that was parked on the property. It's a van, right? And one of the people in the house got away, and there were things in that van that could have been very important to the concerns of the crowd. We do have a bit of good news, though. The two girls, the Perkins children, were found. The next day, on Wednesday, police reported first that one child had been found, then that both children were found and were with their families. At the time, Milwaukee PD stated they had found no evidence that these children were ever at the house that was set on fire. They additionally found no evidence that the children were involved with any of the events that occurred during this investigation, turned into a protest, turned into unrest at that site on Tuesday. I did find one thing that's interesting. I was looking for the names of the people who live in this house. And this is, according to the neighborhood, this is one of those houses that everybody kind of talks about. I think we all grow up with a creepy house in some neighborhood, and this one had been the subject of a lot of scrutiny, but I was having trouble finding who actually lived there. I eventually found some folks. One person, Jaleesa Hall, was a resident of the house, but she wasn't there during the events of Tuesday, June 23rd. She was at St. Joe's Hospital when the home was burning down because she was giving birth. That has got to be a very tough day for her.
And as we've kind of, you know, hinted at, there's a real division between the narratives of the Facebook live streamers and the folks that are assembled and the police, the official story. And we're going to get more into those discrepancies after a quick word from our sponsor.
Okay, we're back. Now, we're going to hear from the police, their side of the story here, and much of what we've learned has come from Police Chief Alfonso Morales of the Milwaukee Police Department. He's given several public addresses about this. The primary one came on Tuesday. That was immediately following the events that we've been talking about just now, the house being burned and everything that went down at that location. So here's what we've got. According to him and the police in general, they responded to that 2100 block of North 40th Street on Monday. So that's the day after the girls were reported missing. He's got logs that show the police department went there twice on Monday night, not to that particular house, but to that area. They went once at, according to these logs, 10:11 p.m. for, quote, trouble with a subject call. Then again, an hour later for a report of some threat. There was this televised statement that you can watch right now on YouTube if you want to look for it yourself. He gave it on Tuesday. That's the one we're referring to here. He announced that police responded to multiple incidents and reports at that general location and several other places there, claiming both times that officers checked the location. They found nothing that would seem to indicate that the children were there, right, or were ever there. The police said that while they were there, and this should be on Tuesday, if I'm not mistaken, guys, that there was exchange of gunfire at, and it was between somebody inside the house, the one that ended up getting burned, and people who were attempting to get into the house. In this statement, Chief Morales characterizes the civilians that we've been talking about who are outside the house as vigilantes, very purposefully so, I think.
Sure.
And he's also not wrong, but it's also...
It's a loaded term. I mean, is there... Right? It's, again, trying to control that narrative and steer that narrative, right?
Exactly. And after he, you know, just gave his prepared statement, he was then asked several questions by reporters.
Yeah, this is interesting. So this is something that I clocked. I've been following this since it occurred, just to see what's shaking out here. This part of the state of the televised statement is fascinating because reporters are openly asking. They're saying, you know, how do you respond to the numerous Milwaukee residents who think police don't care about reports of missing children if they're Black? How do you respond to the continuing allegations that these missing children cases do not get the attention they deserve and the police don't take them as seriously as they should? And then the same reporter follows up and says, and what about the fact that the houses in this area have been known in the past as proven locations of sex trafficking or human trafficking? The reporter is saying this. This isn't me. And the police chief kind of dodges the question. And Morales responds saying, look, the police can only investigate what's reported to us. And then he doubles down on vigilantism. So he doesn't ever actually answer that question. And when he's pushed on it, the question about trafficking and trafficking in the past, he says that the department does not have the necessary information to make a statement. Another reporter confirms that the house had multiple calls to police over time. And then in response, Morales says the same families lived there since 2017, which is an answer, but it's an answer to an entirely different question.
Is this saying calls from the house to the police over time or calls recording the house is suspicious or something?
The police have received reports about the house multiple times. Some of those could have come from inside the house, maybe, you know, it's an aggregate number.
Got it.
This has been reported multiple times. Morales confirms that some people were removed from the residence and refuses to comment when asked about the age of the people who were removed. Those people, by the way, that's an interesting story. They were removed, hidden under yellow tarps and shuffled away into vehicles.
A point for that, though, in any case, I think you're going to want to keep the identity of those people hidden because you are talking about a gathered group of people who appear to be angry and they have an idea of what they believe is going on there. And if it is not proven with evidence, then, you know, the people in that house could be completely innocent and we just don't know. And if they are, right, then mob mentality could kick in and those people could be, you know, harmed, physically harmed. And even if they are guilty, it would be on the police to protect those people until they get a trial, right? Or until they're indicted in some way for some wrongdoing. So protecting them, covering them, I don't know. To me, that doesn't feel odd.
Yeah, I mean, even Batman gets it wrong sometimes. And that's the problem when you take matters into your own hands and then maybe you're manipulated or maybe, you know, I don't know. There's any number of things that can happen. But when you don't have that due process, it's pretty tricky if you rush to judgment.
There are also a number of reasons that these people could have been removed from the residence. And not all of those reasons are that they were detained for some sort of crime. You know, if gunfire did come from a member of the residence, then maybe it was discharge of a firearm. If multiple people are removed, then maybe it's entirely for their personal safety. To your point, Matt, about a powder keg mentality, right, in a crowd. And that's not picking on this crowd in particular. That's just what crowds are built to do. They have that capacity hardwired. I do want to point out, if I could finish this thought, that Batman is one of my least favorite examples of vigilantism. He's a really smart guy. He's also a multi-billionaire, and that's a superpower. If you think about it, Batman is above the law, and he has a superpower. He has time travel. Money is just work over time. He didn't build that cave himself. I know it's unrelated, but I have to say it. I'm sorry, Matt. What were you going to say?
Oh, if a person inside that home was discharging a firearm because they were human beings attempting to breach the home, and that is that person's home, depending on, you know, the laws, in a lot of places, that is completely okay if you're discharging a firearm within your own home to protect your home. So that's just something we have to keep in mind.
Yeah, like a castle doctrine, it's sometimes called.
Mm-hmm.
And now we see these discrepancies, right? Writ large and apparent. It's completely understandable that these discrepancies would exist. While the police characterized this as an otherwise normal investigation pushed off the rails by an angry crowd of, you know, what they characterize as vigilantes, people believe there's more to the story. Some, in fact, currently believe that the police were not just being negligent, but that they were actively covering up a trafficking ring, a conspiracy to kidnap, exploit, and sell children. Here's where it gets crazy.
You guys remember Frank Nitti? We mentioned him earlier. He was in charge of the Facebook live stream that eventually amassed around 40,000 active streamers. He's a community organizer. There were several folks that were live streaming, but his was the most popular. And he kind of narrated the whole thing and kind of did a play-by-play. His beef with this whole situation was the perceived lack of care on the part of police in general in regards to missing children, as well as his community's belief that the children had gone missing in this house. And he added a couple of other slightly disconcerting details. First, he says there was a, quote, guy in the van, the kind of classic, you know, Kaiser Soze mythical crime scene figure. This van was supposedly attacked, and then this individual got away. This is according to Nitti. Second, he explains that part of why the crowd felt that this home in particular was a sex trafficking hub was because at least one child was placed from the residence into a car. He says that he witnessed this and then ran away. Yeah, those are some interesting details that you're not going to see in any of the other reports, and, you know, could well be because they didn't happen, but it also could be that they were brushed over.
So Frank Nitti is a community organizer, and he was, like several people in the crowd, live streaming these events. He was also trying to keep things from going out of hand, right, from turning into a full-on riot. So he was acting as sort of a diplomat, an ambassador between the authorities and between this civilian crowd. He spoke with a Sergeant Todd Smolin, and this was shortly before 7 p.m. And Smolin told Nitti, you know, look, you and these other members of this crowd, these other civilians are, quote, being used. The implication of that is still a little unclear. And Nitti negotiated with the authorities, basically saying, look, if you do the following things, if you at least get this, he calls it a tank, but it's probably an MRAP. If you get this MRAP out of here, then we can move the protest away. We want this to end peacefully. We don't want any more violence. No more throwing bricks or Molotov cocktails or children getting shot, which again did happen. So he walked away saying that he felt as organizers, they were helping the general situation. But then he says, there's an interesting quote here from his live stream. He says, before we came out here, there were 9 kids missing. After we came out here, 4 kids were returned. He later amended it and said 3 kids. So that seems like, at least in his mind, there's something deeper to the story than the 2 missing Perkins children.
And you're right. The big question here, Ben, is why did 2 missing kids, you know, who were being reported by the mother that the police were allegedly not looking into, but of course, according to them, they were. Why did it immediately go to these children are victims of sex trafficking of some sort? You know, it's one of those terrible things that is a reality in a lot of places in the world where it's a possibility, at least, where a child can be abducted and abused in that way. But why this time? Well, it's because the city where this took place, Milwaukee, has a very deep and very dark problem with sex trafficking. And we'll tell you about it after a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. You're correct, Matt. Milwaukee is unfortunately not unique in this problem. And, you know, Atlanta, for instance, Washington, D.C., cities in Texas and California have their own ongoing battles with human trafficking and then with also with child trafficking for sexual purposes. I found this local news station, WTMJ-TV, and in January 2020, they reported on a very disturbing trend. Police in Milwaukee have responded to more than 70 calls from 2015 to 2020 for human trafficking. And that's not the whole city. Those 70 calls are from 5 hotels. 65 arrests related to human trafficking occurred around this area on a single stretch of road. Again, that's not the entire, that's one stretch of road. They did have a dedicated human trafficking task force that addressed 4 areas of concern: public awareness, service provision, education, and legislation. As far as we could find, this task force, after they were created, they made their final report in 2012. Astute conspiracy realist, you'll note that that final report in 2012 occurs 3 years before that horrifying stat about just how many trafficking calls are happening in just one area of town. So it appears that there are clusters, there are hubs, and, you know, I think it's still a stretch to accuse the authorities of being complicit in this, but clearly their attempts to address it have, at the very least, not been 100% effective. Is that a fair way to say it?
I think it absolutely is. And to take it even a little further, or maybe even backtrack slightly, you know, the situation here with the police force being stretched thin because of events going on elsewhere in the city really do feel like, you know, different enough that maybe that led to the delay in response. It doesn't feel like it was a willful delay to me. But I see what you're saying, Matt. Like, you know, if this is a known sex trafficking area or with that problem in general, that maybe they would take the report more seriously without it having to have checked those Amber Alert boxes. Is that, I think, what the discussion is here?
Oh, as in, like, if the 2 girls who went missing in June of this year, if the report was that they were in that area, they would have been, it would have been taken seriously. Is that
I'm wondering, I don't know. I'm just wondering, like, if the police were being derelict because of their, you know, knowledge about sex trafficking being such a problem in the city, and they didn't take these calls seriously enough, what would have maybe led them to take it more seriously? I mean, that, like, how could they have done a better job in this situation, I guess, is what I'm asking.
That's tough, because according to the police, they did take it seriously and they responded immediately and began investigating, right? At least according to them.
Right.
Yeah. So, and we, you know, we know, especially living in Atlanta, that cities and police departments across the United States and the world really appear, at least according to the statistics and to personal experience, to have issues with responding to missing Black people, to murdered Black people, like in the same way that they would respond to someone who is not Black, who is either missing or murdered.
I'm talking about the Atlanta child murders as a prominent example. I mean,
I'm referring
example,
to that
right?
as one of the yeah. sagas that the country and people within it have gone through, where loved ones disappear and then there doesn't seem to be much action taken. And whether that lack of action is perceived or real, it doesn't really matter to the individual who has a missing loved one.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good point. And also, if we journey a little bit further away from the official narrative, we see some distressing claims. The Milwaukee Independent has some largely unsubstantiated claims. I'm not saying they're not true. I'm saying I couldn't find multiple sources confirming. But they have some unsubstantiated claims that the entire set of stories, I should say, has yet to be released to the public. And they say there is also hard evidence of trafficking occurring at this site just south of Washington Park. In a specific quote, they say some papers were recovered, including what was allegedly, since the document has not been released, a schedule of what time the girls were solicited out and the name of someone who was connected to the operation. They then name this person, who they say is, they believe, is the property owner of the residence, a disaster recovery specialist who had been, again, allegedly working as a spiritual leader for children at local youth camps.
And Ben, just to clarify, the site that we're talking about here in reference to, is this the home that was burned, or is this that area where the hotels were? Where are we actually talking about?
That's why I said a set of stories, because what we notice here is that there are three stories occurring. That's what I would categorize this as. The first story is the story of two missing children who are thankfully found alive. The second story is the story of a house that burned down and was believed to be a hub of human trafficking by some people, by civilians in Milwaukee. And the third larger story, in which those two earlier stories take place, is the tragic tale of human trafficking in Milwaukee overall, best evidenced by that terrifying report of the trafficking conspiracy occurring in just one part of town, unrelated, I would say. Possibly related, it depends on how far you think these kind of webs extend. But again, you know, in Milwaukee Independent, I want to emphasize, I did not find additional evidence. The papers that they're talking about, they're alleging that police investigators, when they entered the house at that 2100 block, they're saying that the investigators found papers there and just haven't released them to the public. And then the house burned down. So according to the latest reports we could find, the police do suspect four people of arson. That's a big question. Probably a lot of our fellow listeners are wondering, right? Who started the fire? We didn't start the fire. One of the four suspects in the arson has been arrested. Police were still looking for the rest as of the end of June. That may have changed. But again, we have a happily ever after ending here, at least partially, you know, these two children were found. They were able to return to their families, but there's a bizarre part of the story. No one knows where they were for 3 days. Imagine you have a 15-year-old, a 13-year-old, and just gone for 3 days. I have never been in charge of a teenager, thankfully, but I assume that's abnormal.
Anyone who does have children out there, or maybe if you're even imagining having a child at some point in your life, it's hard to know what you would do to make sure that child is safe or to get them back if you think they're missing. You know, I don't want to put you on the spot, Noel, but
do it, man.
As the father of, you know.
She's what they call a tween, Matt. But yeah, no, it's true. I mean, and honestly, she does a lot of this cosplay stuff. You know, we allowed her to have her own Instagram account. And we've had to be very explicit with her because some of it is the kind of stuff that weird pervy dudes could get off on. I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to mince words here. And she understands that. And she's super careful. And it's a private account. You have to, you know, request access and she has to know who you are. And she knows that she, if she ever got creeped on or anyone was trying to be like, come meet me or something like that, she's like, she's smart. She knows what's up. But yeah, you have to be pretty vigilant about that kind of thing. But you also don't want to make your kids living in fear of being abducted or being exploited or something. But you have to have a healthy fear of that, you know, that contingent, which absolutely exists out in the world. So it's a fine line between living in some kind of constant state of anxiety and just being smart.
I think one of the biggest things here is just imagining that if something did happen, you know, to your child and there is this house or this area somewhere near where you live that has, at least according to other people who live in the community with you, has been reported or attempted to have been reported for things like this, like abducting children, and nothing seems to be happening to that house or to the people who are in that house or in that area, right? And then your child goes missing, and what do you do? You know, this whole story is just really, it's disturbing on a lot of levels, but I think the fact that as a community, there was an alarm or an attempt to switch that alarm on, right? Hey, something is wrong here. Something's going on here. We can't confirm it right now, but you're the police. Please check it out and make sure everything's okay. And it seems to not have happened.
Yeah, because again, as we established at the top of this show, these sorts of concerns or allegations, they don't come out of nowhere. You know what I mean? Even if these allegations end up not being correct, they are not works entirely of fantasy. It reminds me of the panic in Central America, in Guatemala specifically, where there was there's a long-standing rumor, it may still be there, of foreigners going into the country to abduct children for the purpose of harvesting their organs. And it sounds crazy there, you know, when you just hear the sentence that plainly. Just like it might sound crazy to some of us hearing people in Milwaukee say the police are aiding a child trafficking ring. But we have to remember, you know, in the case of Guatemala, this was happening. This urban legend came about because there was a seed of truth to the idea of child abduction and trafficking. And so in Milwaukee, there is an established problem with human trafficking. People are not making all of this up for funsies or something, and it's incredibly disrespectful. I would say it's unclean to dismiss those claims out of hand without giving them due diligence. I know alarmism sells and stuff, but if we're talking about people's lives, we always have to take it seriously. And this is where we get to social media, the gift and the curse, right? Social media tells a story that is far different from the official narrative of the Milwaukee PD in several key ways. And again, this all has to be qualified as speculation. There have been no papers found or publicly acknowledged that show something as explicit as like a schedule of solicitation and trafficking. And if you think about it, that kind of be a weird thing to write down unless you wanted blackmail or extortion abilities later. But I doubt this was Russian kompromat or something like that. The social media stuff, it has the same reports. You can see it on Twitter. You can see it on Facebook. You'll see people claiming that neighbors in the area have been trying to report this house multiple times. They got no results for maybe months or years before this event. And then it gets to the question of the fire. The fire actually happened. Why did it happen? You'll find people on social media saying that the fire was purposely set ablaze to hide evidence, not by an angry quote unquote mob, but maybe by someone working with the police, working with this trafficking ring. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Certainly would be counterproductive of the mob to set the house on fire if, in fact, it was the site of these abuses. It would be very short-sighted at the very least of them to give in to that kind of anger and just go all out in that direction if they really were concerned with justice and finding out the truth. Because if you burn that house down, you basically obliterate all possible evidence and the ability to actually bring anyone potentially, you know, involved in these crimes to justice, right?
For sure. You know, we were talking off mic a little bit, but there are photographs you can see on Twitter. That's how we saw them. They're photographs of the van or a van in the back of the house that was burned as much as the house itself was. I do not know. I cannot confirm. Maybe you guys can. I cannot. If that van is the one that we've talked about a few times throughout this story, it seems like it may have been, but I can't give you 100% proof. Yes, that's the one, but it was burned. And allegedly there was a bed in that van, and it looks like there may have been one, even in the charred remains of it. And there was also allegedly a pair of bloody shorts, I think, that was located there, at least according to some people. If you burn it, then how do you get DNA evidence from that? The other thing I would point out here is that just when you're thinking about motivation of why the house would burn outside of it being purposefully done to hide evidence, and this is me kind of putting myself in the shoes of somebody else here, but if you imagine that you know that this house for sure in your mind is a hub of sex trafficking and the police don't seem to be doing anything about it, what can I do? Well, I'm going to burn that thing to the ground, right? That I can imagine that that's the mindset, at least, that went into attempting to set the house on fire.
Yeah, this is possibly an example of what people do when we feel powerless, when we want to confront something that we otherwise feel incapable of confronting. One thing that is important to note here is that the residents, Chad, I believe 4 adults and 2 children on the books is living there. That residence is gone. The people who lived there have no place to go, including Jaleesa Hall, who, as we said, was giving birth while her house was burning. I found a GoFundMe page that was created by her sister-in-law to raise money for the family so that they would have a place to sleep. They would be able to replace some of the many possessions that burned down in the fire. I'm saying this because I want to establish that there are people who are living there. Their lives go on. You know what I mean? And if you look at this GoFundMe, that story, of course, it's not like the New York Times or ProPublica in terms of reporting or something, but it doesn't show any mention of crime or human trafficking. It shows that that their house burned down and she lost everything. You know what I mean? And if you look at the comments, then you don't see anybody saying that this is some kind of, you know, money grab on behalf of a trafficking ring. I think it's interesting because it's another conflicting narrative here.
Ben, so, thank you for pointing this out. The one thing I noticed on the post here under the the description, right, of this GoFundMe that we're discussing here. It says she was living upstairs with others, right? And there were others living downstairs. And it says, quote, she nor anyone upstairs had anything to do with what was happening downstairs and were in contact with the proper people during everything and did everything they asked. Unquote. Interesting, right?
Mm-hmm.
It does feel as though, I don't know if that's just speaking to what's being said on social media or the allegations about what's going on, or maybe they have been this person or this family, or maybe they do have information that we just don't know.
And maybe they're being unfairly targeted by the court of public opinion, which has no such thing as due process, right? And has no such thing as innocent until proven guilty. So the allegation here, again, unsubstantiated, is that the police were actively protecting traffickers. That's the worst case scenario, and possibly taking a cut of the profits in return. Police corruption is a real thing, but police corruption tends to occur at an individual or small group level often. It's like factions of things, you know? It's one person going outside the law, and then maybe other people complicit by not reporting that person, right? Or supporting them in their criminal endeavor. The idea that an entire department would be active is less likely. But I don't know. I mean, what do you think? Is this an actual active cover-up or conspiracy on the part of the police department? We found allegations and rumors about this. We found solid proof of Milwaukee's trafficking problem. That's its own web of conspiracies. But we didn't find hard evidence of police participation in trafficking. We found a lot of evidence that people in Milwaukee feel police are not doing all they can or should with reports of missing children. But here also, you know, we have to ask, where did this trafficking concern come from? Is it something that grew in the susurrus of uncertainty during, you know, a crowd's protest as it began moving as a unit? It's a known problem in Milwaukee. I don't know.
It's tough to know any of that stuff. But Ben, I'm going back really quickly to what you were talking about with individual police officers and corruption and, you know, small groups of people working together in a corrupt way when dealing with any kind of authority group like that. I would just say when there is a powerful person involved that is more powerful than a police officer or a lieutenant or a chief even involved in any kind of activity, I think that's when corruption really comes into play. And I'm speaking completely on generalities here, but we've seen in the past on a couple episodes where when somebody very, very powerful, we're talking politicians, maybe even a religious leader or somebody who holds sway over a lot of other people, is involved in doing something illegal or nefarious or downright monstrous, as in human sex trafficking with children, the necessary amount of cooperation with a police force on a wide scale, I think, rises.
I see what you're saying. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it's true that in the past, the allegations of this sort have been proven. You know what I mean? If this were true, it would unfortunately not be the first case. It's just, and this is entirely my own perspective, I did not find stuff that I thought was hard evidence of trafficking. And maybe that's because there's more to the story that hasn't been put out there, you know, at which point I would propose that we pass the torch to our fellow conspiracy realists. I mean, what do you think? Do you think this is panic on part of a crowd? However well-intentioned, do you think that there is more to the story? Why are there discrepancies between the official accounts and the accounts that we see from civilians or from people reacting to this online. We want to know. And if you're from Milwaukee, tell us what you can about what appears to be an ongoing struggle with human trafficking. And again, not to pick on Milwaukee, this is unfortunately a common problem in a lot of cities and a lot of U.S. cities. I mean, pre-pandemic, we can't forget, Atlanta, Georgia had the world's busiest airport. It was a trafficking hub. So we're aware of that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know. This does seem like a perfect storm of anger and resentment toward the police and miscommunication. And the big problem with these live streams, like, on the one hand, yeah, it's great. They can proliferate and raise awareness for an issue, but it's also, with the internet, it's really easy for misinformation to move very quickly, just as quickly as good information, and oftentimes more quickly because people like a juicy story. And oftentimes that misinformation is a little grabbier. It's a little sexier and clickbaity. And so that's the stuff that people spread and report. And it's just one of these things where we always encourage people to do their own research before blindly, you know, putting forth some kind of narrative that maybe doesn't contain all the facts.
So write to us. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook. Again, tell us your thoughts on this and anything else you want to talk about. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're Conspiracy Stuff. On Instagram, we're Conspiracy Stuff Show. If you want to give us a call, we have a number. It's 1-833-STDWYTK. You can leave a message. Maybe it'll get on the air on an episode on this show. Or, hey, we'll just hear it and we'll be delighted or horrified by what it is you have to say. Hopefully delighted.
You can also find us in the usual social media channels. We're some form of Conspiracy Stuff or Conspiracy Stuff Show on Instagram, Twitter, and our favorite place on the internet, our internet home, is our Facebook group. Here's where it gets crazy, where you can hang out with your fellow conspiracy realists, engage in conversations about new episodes, let us know stuff that you'd like to see us cover. And it's just a really good group there. And you can join that group just by naming any of the four of us, make Ben laugh, or just, you know, indicate that you definitely know this is a podcast and a group associated with said podcast. The barrier to entry is pretty low. Also, if you would be so kind and you like the show, you like what you hear, why not head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a nice review? It seems like a small thing, but it really does help people discover the show by influencing the ranking on the Apple Podcast chart. So go over there and leave us a 5-star review or whatever you think is fair. We won't have our feelings hurt, but we really appreciate you. And like Ben says, you're the most important part of the show.
And if you do choose to go that route and leave a review of any kind, please do not forget to mention our benefactors, Illumination Global Unlimited. They really, they haven't been seeing the love that they generally get lately, and we need to make sure that that's happening. Please?
Yes. Not all debts are in gold, I believe. If you would like to contact us in social media is not your bag of badgers, and you hate phones, totally makes sense. We have one last way you can always contact us any day of the year, any day of the week, any time of the day. And that is our good old-fashioned email address, where we are.
Conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.